And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. April is National Poetry Month, and we are dipping into the morning show archives to replay a memorable conversation recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2001 with Rebecca Presson Mosby, one of the editors of an extraordinary release from Sourcebooks called Poetry Speaks. Here, great poets read their work from Tennyson to Plath, a book which includes a companion compact disc in which one can listen to great poets reading their own poetry.
There are, of course, all kinds of different ways to write. There's all kinds of writing besides poetry. But I think it's fair to say that poetry...
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two novelists as guests today. Part one, a newly recorded interview. The other, from the morning show archives, an interview recorded back in 2009. Here's part one. I am so pleased to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with an outstanding playwright and screenwriter and now novelist, Kevin Wade. It is very likely that you have... And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD.
Careless.
I'm Gregory Berg.
And in the
April is National Poetry Month, and we are dipping into the morning show archives to replay a memorable conversation recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2001 with Rebecca Presson Mosby, one of the editors of an extraordinary release from Sourcebooks called Poetry Speaks. Here, great poets read their work from Tennyson to Plath, a book which includes a companion compact disc in which one can listen to great poets reading their own poetry.
There are, of course, all kinds of different ways to write. There's all kinds of writing besides poetry. But I think it's fair to say that poetry has a very unique magic and mystique all its own. Can you explain it to us? What is the power of poetry versus the power of other kinds of writing?
Well, I think, you know, other people have probably stated it better than I. You know, Gwendolyn Brooks, of course, calls it life distilled. And I think that the notion of having our innermost thoughts and feelings expressed in just a few words is a very compelling thing. And I think there are any number of us who are drawn in, very much drawn in by the idea of having a better understanding of ourselves, in relatively short space of time like that. Well, I don't know for sure, but I do know that many, many years before there was written language, people remembered their personal histories and their tribal histories through lyrics, through poems. And, you know, poetry, I think, is meant to be heard.
Let's talk about this particular project, the book Poetry Speaks. The book itself, and the three companion compact discs which accompany it. First of all, how did you yourself personally become involved in the project?
Believe it or not, someone at Sourcebooks just found me on the internet.
Really?
Yeah, and called me and was picking my brain, and I realized immediately that this was a project that I wanted to be associated with, and indeed should be associated with, since I have a wide background in finding archival audio of poetry. And I sort of talked my way into it.
into coming on board.
Yeah, that's right.
So were you involved in the assembling of these particular poems and these particular poets and these recordings? I mean, were you part of the decision-making process?
Absolutely. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
I was hired at the very beginning when we started the project. It was a germinal idea when I found out about it.
So tell us about the process of deciding who should be included in this particular collection?
Right, that was really tough. We started with a list of about eight. We had to decide fairly early on that we were going to use only historical poets, meaning, of course, only dead poets. And so that was one of our very first decisions. And then after that, we made a list of about 80 poets that we were interested in. And then I went out and found out how many of those poets had actually been recorded. And then armed with that information, we sent this enormous list to our advisory editors, who included the former Poets Laureate Robert Pinsky and Rita Dove, and also Dana Gioia, a poet. And they took the list down to about 50. Well, they and Elise Passion, my co-editor, and I, we all did that independently. And then Elise and I took that list of 50 names and came up with 40, with 44, I believe it was. But a couple of poets we couldn't find audio for, a couple of poets we couldn't get permission for, and then in the meantime, Gwendolyn Brooks died, and so we added one. You know, it was in flux all along, in other words.
Right. Tell me a little bit about the decision made right off the bat to focus only on deceased poets.
Well, you know, it was just too tough. It would have meant dealing with, I think, a lot of ego issues and issues of judgment that maybe shouldn't be made while a poet is still living. You know, I think you can really look at a poet's body of work better if you've had some time to reflect back on it. And in this case, I really think that was true. Having, you know, hindsight is useful. And if the poet's been, if the poet's not writing any longer, then you have that. You have hindsight. Hmm.
You say that in some ways, much of the responsibility fell to you to determine which of these poets had indeed been recorded.
Right.
Tell me about that investigative process. How did you determine that?
Well, you know, I did those. You mentioned in your introduction that I'd done these projects for Rhino Records that were similar types of projects. So I've kind of been tracking down archival audio, which is one reason, you know, I was able to worm my way into this job since about almost 10 years. And so I had a pretty good notion when we started of what libraries had significant collections of recorded poetry and of who had been recorded. You know, nonetheless, it didn't stop us from going out and trying to find other poets and sleuthing. And in fact, there were some wonderful discoveries. For example, this Tennyson recording has never been published before. There is a recording from the Tennyson Society, but it's different from this one, which came from Yale University. And it's better quality audio, too.
And how did you, for instance, discover that? And how do they have it?
Actually, the archivist at their sound archive knew about it, and I knew him from the past, but for some reason it never came up before. And this time he mentioned it. And it was just, you know, it's just a wonderful recording, and it was quite a discovery.
Hustling on earth, all is the valley of death for all citizens. All the light brigade march for the country set into the valley of death for all citizens. All the light brigade was there a man dismayed, not so the soldier knew someone. There's not to make reply, there's not to reason why, there's but to do and die, into the valley of death, death, all disappointed. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered.
Right. This is maybe as good a time as any to talk a little bit about the whole area, or the whole notion of archival audio, and the fact that so many of these kind of spoken word recordings exist, that this was an important part of the earliest days of the recording industry, in some ways more important than musical recordings, odd as it may seem.
Well, you know, Thomas Edison was brilliant in many ways, and that, of course, includes having made these wonderful inventions, such as the wax cylinder. But he also had the idea of saving history for posterity. I mean, he went out right away. The wax cylinder was really a very new invention when he sent a couple of them over to England in 1888 and had the great poets of the day recorded, Alfred Lord Tennyson and Robert Browning. And this is because, you know, poets were big stars in the 19th century and in the early 20th century as well. And so, you know, both of these men would have been pretty much household names in Britain and in America. Something that we can't quite understand, I don't think, nowadays, but
right,
that was very well understood then.
I have seen someplace a very interesting list, apparently made by Edison, listing what he saw to be the most important uses for his then brand new invention of the phonograph.
Oh.
And what's interesting is it's a list of, as I recall, a list of maybe 10 potential uses for the phonograph, and music is kind of buried right in the middle of the list. It's maybe number 6 or number 7, and I wish I had a clearer recollection of what some of the other items were on that list, but it's very apparent that Edison thought of music as being rather tangential in value, and that really the heart and soul of what he had in mind, the most exciting possibilities for him, were the recording of
the human voice.
Yes,
yeah.
for language and historical purposes and political discourse and whatever. And oh yeah, and I suppose you could record music on this thing also. And,
which yeah, imagine that.
Now we think of that as such a central thing. Where is archival sound generally kept, collected? Where does one go to try to find it?
Well, I think the richest source is the Library of Congress. We're really lucky in having the Library of Congress because someone there had the same sort of insight and foresight that Edison had, and the Library of Congress has been recording poets actively since the 30s, and so it's a wonderful resource, and it's also accessible to all of us, you know, as Americans. Nobody tries to, you know, claim that the library owns it or anything like that. If you can get permission from the estate, you can use the audio that's at the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty fabulous to be able to do, for starters. And then there are many universities that have wonderful collections. Yale, I just mentioned. Harvard has also got a terrific collection. And then there are lots of other university collections. And, you know, actually, New Letters on the Air is a pretty significant collection, although it doesn't go as far back as Harvard or Yale or the Library of Congress. I mean, you're not going to find 19th century recordings there.
Right.
You know, they're kind of scattered here and there. And then there are, there's a poetry library in San Francisco where there are a good number of recordings. I can't give away all my secrets.
But you have this little network from the sounds of it.
I do, in fact, yeah, that's right.
Due to the work that you've been doing over these many years. One of the questions that I think is quite intriguing when one picks up a book like this is the assumption that there is a special value in hearing the poet read his or her poetry,
mm-hmm,
versus somebody else, versus, for instance, a well-trained actor or actress or lecturer, orator. I want to find out from you, first of all, what you think that particular value, what exactly is it that we gain by hearing Carl Sandburg reading his own poetry, for instance, or any
right,
poet in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's several things. First of all, I think you learn from listening to the poet what the poet's intentions were in the poem, because almost all poets write for sound, most poets write for sound, and they have a certain music in mind when they write their poem. Whether or not it's metered or rhymed, they're thinking about the way the words sound against each other. And even if the poet is not a great reader, as is often the case, he or she does know how he or she wants the emphases to be made, like what line endings are stronger, or where there's something in the center, or what words should be bounced off each other. So I think that's interesting to begin with. But then there's also simply the fact that you have that immediate connection with the creator. And I think that's one reason why museums have become so popular in recent years, is that there's something really immediate about standing in front of a canvas. You know, if you're standing in front of a Caravaggio, you know, it's just possible that some of his DNA might be on that canvas, or a hair from his brush. You know, I mean, there's this extraordinary connection. You know, we will never hear Bach play his own music, but we can see that, we can hear Tennyson read his poetry, and we can, you know, look at a Rembrandt.
I just recently did an interview with the curator of photography at the Art Institute of Chicago. They have a marvelous Ansel Adams Centennial exhibit on display right now. And one of the things which is on view in this exhibit is a series of multiple prints in which, over the course of years, Ansel Adams has taken a given photograph of his and printed it again in a slightly different way. And so you're essentially viewing exactly the same photograph as one he maybe printed a decade or two or three earlier, but he has printed it in a slightly different way, and it becomes new, and these are hung together, and one can view his different takes. It occurred to me that although we don't see anything represented in this collection, and probably for some obvious reasons, do we have any archival audio which allows us to hear different ways in which someone like Carl Sandburg, for instance, read a given poem, or is that something that just eludes us?
In many cases, yes. For example, Robert Frost was recorded many, many, many times. And so you in fact, everything, both of my collections, my Rhino collection, In Their Own Voices, and this, have The Road Not Taken, for example, and they're two different recordings. So you can compare them. And there are a couple of recordings of Edna St. Vincent Millay reading Recuerdo. Again, it's the same thing. The one in Their Own Voices is different from this one. There are many recordings of Langston Hughes reading The Negro Speaks of Rivers. The other thing that there is, that's sort of along the same line, that's really interesting, I think, is that we have we can also see the editorial process through some of these recordings, because many of the poems are different in the audio than they are in the text, because the poets either made some decision somehow to revise or change their work, either as they read it or after they read it. In some cases, like with Anne Sexton, she published these poems that she reads in the audio, The Truth the Dead Know and The Operation, less than a year after she recorded them. But when she published them, she had done extensive rewrites.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting, I think, yeah.
So
you know, you get that historical aspect, but you also get to know the process of writing.
Hmm. I know there's a poem in this volume, for instance, that talks about the piling up of corpses in the wake of a battle. I can't think of now what poem that is.
I think you're thinking of Carl Sandburg Grass.
Oh,
Pile the Bodies High at Auschwitz.
Oh, I think
so.
Yeah, and I think in that poem, in the recording, we're given another place where the corpses should be piled, and it's not in the printed poem.
Yes, and that's because the other place is Stalingrad.
That's right.
And Stalingrad, of course, didn't even exist in 1918 when he wrote the poem, but he recorded it in the 50s, and he wanted to bring this poem to a contemporary audience and have them understand that it was not a dead poem, or a poem that had no relevance to the time.
Wow.
Pile the bodies high at Austerlitz and Waterloo. Shovel them under and let me work. I am the grass. I cover all. and pile them high at Gettysburg, and pile them high at Ypres, Verdun, Stalingrad. Shovel them under and let me work. 2 years, 10 years, and passengers ask the conductor, what place is this? Where are we now? I am the grass. Let me work.
So one editorial decision that you made was to how these poems would be printed, and if the printed word would exactly correspond to the recorded word. And what decision did you end up making? Does that vary through the book?
Not really. We made a decision on what was the definitive printed edition of the poem. And we used that, and it really didn't have a great deal of bearing on the audio version, because the audio version was, you know, the audio version, and we always thought that it would be a delight and a surprise to hear how things could change from place to place.
As it came time to choose specific poems, did you find yourself pulled between the greatest poems, the finest poems, and those poems which are particularly effective when heard out loud? Because I think you'll agree that there probably are certain poems that are maybe most impressive
on
the printed page.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a good question, and you're quite right. For example, Melvin B. Tolson was somebody that I was familiar with, but most of the other people on the project, excepting, of course, Rita Dove, were not. And once people heard the recording, they were completely convinced that he should be included. But, you know, it was just, based on his reputation, it was a tough sell. But based on his ability as a reader, it suddenly became very clear that he belonged in the project.
When you first began talking about the project, you yourself mentioned that there is historical interest in all of these recordings, despite the fact that some of these poets, again, I'm quoting you, might not be great readers.
Right.
I want you to talk a little bit more about that, and be specific if you like, but
sure.
Talk about poets that are not great readers. And do we find in some cases here that we have poets reading their works in ways in which it's maybe interesting for a rather negative rather than positive reason?
Well, of course, it's always a matter of your opinion, too, whether or not someone is a great reader. For example, William Butler Yeats was regarded by many people as a terrible reader in his day, and that's something that Seamus Heaney addresses in his essay about Yeats. And he says, in fact, he opens it by saying opinions are divided about Yeats' way of reading his poem, and then he goes on to say, I have no doubt about which side I'm on. I think Yeats' semi-liturgical utterance is both right and revealing. Once you hear the heightened voice and the suspended syntax, the help line and the pointed rhyme, you understand that for him, the poem was first and foremost a bodying forth of sound. And so, you know, when we listen to the recording, I think a lot of us will hear, a lot of contemporary people, especially young people, I imagine, will hear Yeats as sounding really old-timey and strange and melodic and possibly even sing-songy. But you read what Seamus Heaney has to say, and you realize that is a very much a debatable point. There are other people who drove me crazy. There's one poet in this collection that drives me crazy to listen to, and that's Randall Jarrell. The poet who wrote the essay about him absolutely loves his voice and loves the way it matches the poetry. So, you know, these are all, you know, matters of opinion. Peter Sachs is who I was trying to say. These things have a great deal to do with opinion. But what we do always get is a sense of history and how the reading of poetry evolved over time. And also there are connections to be made. For example, Ezra Pound was a friend of Yeats. And if you listen to Pound, he sounds like he's Irish. He's really taken on Yeats' style of reading. They say that Pound affected Yeats as a writer, but clearly Yeats affected Pound as a reader.
Interesting. And do I remember correctly that Yeats is represented here not only reading his poems, but also talking about reading his poems?
That's right.
Defending
his
style, right?
That's exactly right, which is, I think, really interesting. He, as an introduction to the Lake Isle of Innisfree, he gives, you know, a fairly detailed account of why he does what he does. Wonderful.
I'm going to read my poems with great emphasis upon their rhythm. And that may seem strange if you are not used to it. I remember the great English poet, William Morris, coming in a rage out of some lecture hall where somebody had recited a passage out of his Sigurd the Vol song. It gave me a devil of a lot of trouble, said Morris, to get that thing into verse. It gave me the devil of a lot of trouble to get into verse the poems that I am going to read, and that is why I will not read them as if they were prose. I am going to begin with a poem of mine called The Lake Isle of Innisfree, because if you know anything about me, you will expect me to begin with it. It is the only poem of mine which is very widely known. When I was a young lad in the town of Sligo, I read Thoreau's essays and wanted to live in a hut on an island in Loch Gill called Innisfree, which means Heather Island. I wrote the poem in London when I was about 23. One day in the Strand, I heard a little tinkle of water and saw on a shop window a little jet of water balancing a ball on the top. It was an advertisement, I think, of cooling drinks, but it set me thinking of Sligo and lake water. I think there is only one obscurity in the poem. I speak of noon as a purple glow. I must have meant by that the reflection of Heather in the water.
I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning, to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of lilies wing. I will arise and go now, for always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavements grey, I hear it in the deep heart core.
Exactly. We're speaking today with Rebecca Presson Mosby. She is one of the editors of a book called Poetry Speaks, a wonderful book which includes 3 compact discs in which one can hear a number of different poets reading their own work. How many poets, again, are included?
42.
42 poets. Mm-hmm. I wrote down 80. I think that's the figure from when you were deciding what to include.
That's right, uh-huh.
And then you had to go through the, I'm sure, painful process of winnowing that list down to something more manageable. Let's talk about a few specific recordings, if we can, before you need to go. You touched earlier on the fact that there are a couple of precious old recordings that are included here that are not very easy to listen to technically, but which of course must be included. It would be a tragedy not to have them as part of this. Talk about those if you would.
Well, these of course are the 19th century recordings, the wax cylinder recordings, and you know, I think even today everybody knows The Charge of the Light Brigade, right? So hearing Alfred Lord Tennyson read The Charge of the Light Brigade is just thrilling. And what's really wonderful is that both Tennyson and Browning are very aware when they're making these recordings that they are participating in a historical moment. And so Tennyson, one of them does three cheers at the end. There's a room full of men. Browning loses the poem, picks it back up, and then at the end, all the men in the room get up and say three cheers. And both Tennyson and Browning thank Mr. Edison for his wonderful invention.
Oh, at the end of their recording, you mean?
Yeah.
It's
actually on the tape that comes with the book. So that's really swell because they know that this is something important and something historical.
It's really Charles Osgood, your narrator, who suggests to us with these earliest recordings that one really wants to have the book in front of you, or you likely are not going to be able to discern at least many of the words that are being spoken. But if you have the words in front of you, it really is possible then.
Yes, and I think you should start that way. And by the way, you were right in attributing that to me because I wrote the narration.
Oh, very good. I'm glad you said so because that's a very helpful component in all of this, particularly for someone like me, not particularly well-versed in poetry. It's really good to have some of this introductory material, particularly ahead of each of these selections.
Thanks.
Tell me a couple of your favorite voices, and I mean not even so much style of reading or clarity, but just the voice as an instrument. A couple of the most compelling voices in this collection and why you find them compelling.
Well, a couple are so beautifully matched to the work that you have to just love it. I mean, Ogden Nash has such a funny voice. He really sounds like an Ogden Nash poem. So I loved that.
I do, I will, I have. How wise I am to have instructed the doorman to order my carriage. I am about to volunteer a definition of marriage. Just as I know that there are two Hagens, Walter and Copen, I know that marriage is a legal and religious alliance entered into by a man who can't sleep with a window shut and a woman who can't sleep with a window open. Moreover, just as I am unsure of the difference between flora and fauna and flotsam and jetsam, I am quite sure that marriage is the alliance of two people, one of whom never remembers birthdays and the other never forgets them. And he refuses to believe there is a leak in the water pipe or the gas pipe, and she is convinced she is about to asphyxiate or drown. And she says, quick, get up and get my hairbrushes off the windowsill, it's raining in. And he replies, oh, they're all right, it's only raining straight down. That is why marriage is so much more interesting than divorce, because it's the only known example of the happy meeting of the immovable object and the irresistible force. So I hope that husbands and wives will continue to debate and combat over everything debatable and combatable, because I believe a little incompatibility is the spice of life, particularly if he has income and she is patable.
There's so many. I absolutely love listening to Sandberg. That was kind of a revelation. I hadn't listened to him very much, and he just sings his poems. He was originally a speaker of Swedish, and he was also famous as a folk singer. And you can hear it in his reading.
When Abraham Lincoln was shoveled into the tombs, he forgot the copperheads and the assassins in the dust, in the cool tomb. And Ulysses Grant lost all thought of con men and Wall Street. Cash and collateral turned ashes in the dust, in the cool tomb. Pocahontas' body, lovely as a poplar, sweet as a red haw in November or a pawpaw in May. Did she wonder, does she remember in the dust, in the cool? Take any street full of people buying clothes and groceries, cheering a hero or throwing confetti and blowing tin horns. Tell me if the lovers are losers. Tell me if any get more than the lovers. In the dust, in the cool tomb.
One of the readings that other people, that you have to listen to carefully, I think you have to listen a couple of times before you get drawn in, but H.D., when she reads from Helen in Egypt, there's a sort of quivering desperation and urgency in her voice that's really quite amazing.
Tell us about the exceptional rarity of that recording, if you would.
Of H.D.?
Right.
Well, it is, to my knowledge, the only recording of H.D. It was released, just about the same. She died very shortly after making the recording. And it was released by Spoken Arts. This is another one of the treasure troves that I didn't mention earlier of recorded poetry. They did a series in the 50s called The Spoken Arts Treasury of 100 Modern Poets. And, it's a really remarkable and thoughtful collection that foreshadowed everything to come. Cadman and Spoken Arts were really the trailblazers in this area. They're the equivalent of folkways in music. Although folkways, actually, Moses Ash recorded some poetry as well.
The poet Hilda Doolittle, known as H.D., was a member of the inner circle of Ezra Pound and embraced many of the ideas of his Imagist movement, which promoted clarity and brevity. Like the other modernists, which is what Imagists came to be called, H.D. drew from the stories of antiquity for much of her material. This rare recording was made shortly before H.D.'s death and may be the only record of her voice. She reads from the opening passages of a book-length poem titled Helen in Egypt, in which H.D. retells the story of Helen of Troy, placing her in Egypt. The poem is told in the voice of Helen, who addresses the Greek hero Achilles and calls upon his mother, Thetis, goddess of the sea.
That Helen of Sparta, Helen of Troy, Helena, hated of Greece. In a dream or drought, she left Troy. She finds herself in Egypt. How? Why? She does not know, until the image of a lost and shipwrecked Achilles appears. Few were the words we said, nor knew each other, nor asked. Are you spirit? Are you sister? Are you brother? Are you alive? Are you dead? The harpers will sing forever of how Achilles met Helen among the shades. But we were not. We are not shadows. As we walk heel and soul, leave our sandal prints in the sand. Though the wound that heals treads lightly, and more lightly follow the purple sandal.
One of the things that's interesting to me is that some of these recordings were made in a recording studio, in the relative privacy or intimacy of a recording studio,
mm-hmm.
but several of these recordings clearly were not made that way, but were made more in live performance, if you will.
Yeah. You know, there was this guy his name just jumped right out of my head. I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name. It's on the recording, though. It's part of the narration. Who went around in the 50s with a recorder, and he went to all these people's houses and New York City and traveled across country and recorded 500 poets.
Wow.
And all those recordings are at Yale, and many of them are at the Library of Congress as well. And yeah, it's just an amazing thing that somebody, you know, there are always these people who are fascinated with technology, though, don't you?
And it's a lucky for us.
Using it, isn't it? Yeah.
Now, are there? You mentioned earlier. I don't remember now who it was, but there's at least one poet here whose voice or reading style or both really drives you to distraction personally.
Personally, yeah.
Right. Who was that again?
Oh, for me, it was Randall Jarrell.
And any particular thing about
it? He has this sort of very emotional delivery. that that's real. It's interesting at first, but it kind of got on my nerves after a while.
But you set your personal feelings aside, so this could be.
Oh
part
no,
of
we really felt that, and you know, he's an important poet, and
sure.
And it's important to hear. I think it's important to hear the voice. It's wonderful to hear the voice because you get to have some real contact with the artist.
The death of the ball turret gunner. From my mother's sleep, I fell into the state, and I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from Earth, loosed from its dream of life, I woke to black, and the nightmare of fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose.
I think that that is very true in the two recordings that actually conclude the collection, two poems read by Sylvia Plath. And
mm-hmm.
you say, either in the written or spoken introduction, or maybe both, that there is palpable anger in the way in which Sylvia Plath reads really both of these poems. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know... these are from her last book. The poems Daddy and Lady Lazarus are from her last book of poems, which was written in a sort of white-hot frenzy in the year before she committed suicide. And I think that the emotion that she felt, you know, she was obviously mentally ill, it really comes out in the recording. Daddy is a strange poem. It's a real favorite poem of a lot of, especially young people. It's a really, really popular poem and with immense anger. And, of course, many people feel that the anger is not just toward her father. It's also toward her then-husband, Ted Hughes. But it's a little strange because, you know, it contains many sort of specific accusations about, you know, Daddy, you're a Nazi and this. And, of course, he wasn't a Nazi. He lived in the U.S. since well before World War II, and, in fact, he died before World War II. So, you know, it's sometimes you sort of look at it and say, what's that all about?
Mm.
You know, but
right. I mean, it's fascinating to me how in those particular recordings, you are almost nervous listening to them because they are such intimate documents, and it's as though we are peering right into her tortured soul as we hear her read those words. And that's not always the experience, of course. Maybe it seldom is, in a sense. I mean, not that that a recording can't be compelling for other reasons, but it really is something to be sort of in the presence of her raw emotion in those recordings.
That's a good point. Yeah, I agree with you, but I hadn't quite thought of it that way. But yeah, there is a sort of voyeurism involved in some cases, isn't there?
Daddy, you do not do, you do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or hachoo. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time, marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one gray toe, big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you, ach du, in the German tongue in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polack friend says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in a barbed wire snare. Eeh, 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 eeh. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you. And the language obscene, an engine, chuffing me off like a Jew. A Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck, and my tarok pack and my tarok pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat mustache and your Aryan eye, bright blue. Panzerman, Panzerman, oh you, not God but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you.
This is one of those projects I would think that would consume you, and even once it's done, is there at all a sense that, oh, if only this, if only that? First of all, I wonder, are there recordings that you hoped existed or should exist or almost existed that sort of drive you mad, that proved elusive or it's uncertain whether or not that particular poet's voice is preserved?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Certainly, there are. Yeah. There were people that we went after and didn't find. And I found that was true when I did the collection of black poets for Rhino too. You know, surprisingly, Richard Wright seems never to have been recorded, and he's someone I think, you know, that you might think would be recorded, because he certainly lived in a time when he could have been. And so that's frustrating. And we had hoped to find a recording of Edward Arlington Robinson, for example, and we didn't succeed in that. You know, there's the list goes on. People who died young, most of the World War I poets, the great World War I poets, you know, they lived in the recording era, but they, you know, died very young, many of them during the war.
Tell us also the interesting story behind the recording here that represents Walt Whitman, or that perhaps represents Walt Whitman.
That we believe represents Walt Whitman.
Right.
Are you talking about the Galway Canal story?
It's the excerpt from America, I think.
Right, that's, right.
But just the fact, I think Charles Osgood tells us that...
There is some question about whether this is really the voice of Walt Whitman or not. We're not 100% sure. It's the only recording in Poetry Speak that is at all questionable, but... The original wax cylinder has been lost, and so we don't know for certain that this is Walt Whitman. Many people feel that it is, including the Whitman Society in Iowa City. But, you know, it's the original isn't there. So
I think the narration says that your narration, I guess I should call it, is says that it's really because this recording is so good. Its technical quality is so good that
What they said at the Library of Congress. That's what the audio archivist at the Library of Congress thinks. But now, having found this Tennyson recording, I think it's almost as good.
It really is extraordinary. Some of those early cylinders, the amazing clarity, particularly if we have the fortune for them to have been well preserved, they were capable of some amazing things.
Yeah.
Center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike and good, grown, ungrown, young or old, strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law and love.
And what I love is Galway Canal's essay in which, and he had told me this story previously, in which he recalls the first time that he heard this recording. And he was in St. Mark's Cathedral in New York City. And he says that when the recording came on, at the very beginning of the court recording, a flock of bats flew up into the ceiling, down from the ceiling, and they were all over the church. And the minute the recording ended, they all went back up into the ceiling. And so that's his evidence.
Wow. Very good.
Isn't it great? Yeah.
That is great.
I choose to believe that.
Right.
Rebecca Presson-Mosby, one of the editors of Poetry Speaks, Hear Great Poets Read Their Work from Tennyson to Plath, published by Sourcebooks. And this is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.